Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program from WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach, and we're your hosts for this program.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to share these words across the prison walls.
Before we get started with this week's theme, we want to share some prison-related news. It's been a hot week inside jails and prisons across the continent. 80 prisoners in Pittsburgh's Allegheny County Jail initiated a sit-in on March 18th. Their demands included better health care, more access to social workers, and an improved grievance procedure. A combative solidarity demonstration outside the jail was called for that night, leading to attacks on the jail's facade and police vehicles. 11 arrests were made. We're awaiting news of the situation with the protest inside the jail. Prisoners inside a youth detention facility in Val-du-Lac in Quebec rebelled on March 21st, leading to a disturbance and repression. Six youths are charged with illegal assembly, resisting arrest, and obstructing police work. A day of solidarity with prison rebels in Nebraska has been called for today, March 24th. This is in response to a revolt on March 2nd, during which prisoners burned mattresses and took control of the yard. They held up a sign clarifying their demands, making clear that the revolt was against the following: arbitrary placement in segregation, the creation of two classes of inmates, one with access to privileges, the other with loss of privileges, disrespectful treatment by staff, especially by the younger ones with limited experience, and incompatible inmates being placed together in cells. The call includes a request for solidarity actions and the suggestion that you may call Director of Nebraska Corrections Scott Frakes at 402-471-2654 if you want to tell him to listen to the prisoners' demands. We'll have this call-in information on the website as well.
Earlier this month, nonprofit publication Rewire published a report calling attention to the wide-scale criminalization and prosecution faced by survivors of domestic violence for acts committed by their abusive partners. A recent example of this is the pending prosecution of Noor Zahi Salman, the widow of Pulse nightclub shooter Omar Mateen. Salman has been charged with aiding and abetting terrorism because the police believe she could have warned them about her husband's plans and possibly prevented the deaths of his victims. The prosecution dismissed her accounts of intense physical and psychological abuse at the hands of Mateen and discredited his violence toward her as any defense. Unfortunately, this is not uncommon. In fact, the authors explain that, quote, "The adversarial nature of the criminal justice system often does not allow prosecutors to explore nuances such as the effects of domestic violence on a person's ability to act," unquote.
Darren Rainey, a schizophrenic man incarcerated in a Florida prison, spent almost 2 hours locked in a scalding shower and died there. A recent investigation cleared the responsible corrections officers of a crime. The report, issued by a state attorney, claims Rainey's death was an accident, the result of complications of a mental illness, a heart condition, and, quote, "confinement in a shower," unquote. Some six inmates claimed the shower was rigged so guards could control the temperature, turning the water up to very hot or down to freezing. The inmates stated that the guards used the shower to control unruly inmates, most of whom were mentally ill. The state attorney determined that the inmates' claims were not believable. Rainey's autopsy report was never released to the public. However, a preliminary report indicated that he had burns over 90% of his body when it was removed from the shower.
A recent story in the Boston Review highlights the problematic ways in which many people discuss immigrants' rights. It explains that, quote, "For strategic reasons, immigration advocacy has coalesced around dreamers and families of law-abiding immigrants while keeping in the shadows those who are deported on criminal grounds. The consequences of this tactic to emphasize immigrant respectability have been catastrophic for those who have been deported under the guise of criminality, perpetuating a silence that provides cover for a massive deportation regime that must be questioned and dismantled. In 2016, more than 60,000 immigrants were cast out from the United States on criminal grounds. According to ICE, criminal removals comprised 92% of all deportations from the nation's interior last year, compared with only 3% in 1980. Yet immigrants are not committing more crime than in the past. Rather, the definition of criminal has broadened significantly since the 1990s, when the federal government began criminally prosecuting immigration infractions that were previously enforced as civil matters, while also deporting an unprecedented number of immigrants with minor criminal records," unquote. This type of respectability politics is also common in wider public discourse surrounding the victims of police violence.
This week, we're speaking to people about the relationship between homelessness and incarceration. There's often a recurring cycle between these two states, and we wanted to talk to people about how they see that relationship. We start with Forrest Gilmore, who manages Shalom, a local community center that assists people facing various aspects of poverty.
My name is Reverend Forrest Gilmore, and I'm the executive director of the Shalom Community Center. The biggest thing about incarceration at all is that it never makes a person's life easier afterwards. It's always harder. There's always more challenges that follow incarceration. People serving their time, they're doing, you know, what they were supposed to do, but coming out, they have all these other barriers that come with that, from difficulty finding employment, difficulty getting housing, even difficulty getting food stamps in some circumstances, you know, basic government services. And so that's probably the biggest challenge of it, is that it doesn't end when you're released. I mean, maybe in a perfect world it would, but it just gets that much harder afterwards for someone. And so in effect, they're punished for life for whatever crime it was that they committed or were convicted of. One of the things, too, specifically with people experiencing homelessness, is that the act of being homeless itself leads to arrests and to prosecutions and to jail time. That when you're homeless, the whole world is your living room, your bedroom, your bathroom. It's all your private spaces are in the world. And so all the things that happen in the confines of our private spaces, imagine those being exposed to the world. So when you're homeless, just being in a place that you're not supposed to be is called trespassing, and so you go to jail. Or if you are out and homeless and out in the world and you have a mental health problem and you have a mental health breakdown, that could be disturbing the peace. And of course, if you drink too much or get high, then suddenly you have a public intox. So just the act and experience of being homeless increases one's chance of getting arrested in the first place. Now, there's also the potential for targeting and for active prejudicial actions, that noticing people who are wearing not as good clothing or might be carrying a backpack or under greater suspicion. So all these things kind of work together to, in essence, create a cycle of incarceration. The two hardest challenges for anyone getting out of jail or prison right after is housing and employment. I mean, those are the core things that all of us want and need to get back on our feet. And there's an immediate stamp against you once you have that kind of background on your record. If you have multiple arrests, it's even worse, and felonies are the worst of all. There are many landlords who won't even do an application for someone if they have a felony, and in some cases even misdemeanors. So it can be really challenging.
Up next, we have a discussion between Emma, Joe, and Mike about Mike's personal experiences with recurrent homelessness and incarceration.
My name is Mike Feltner. How I started becoming homeless, I lost my mom back in 2009 to OD. My marriage went to craps. And then I started real bad using on Spice. Been in and out of jail for the past 7 years, 7.5 years. And, you know, addiction had a real bad part of my jail time. Cops here know me by name. You know, now they're also proud of me because I'm staying clean. Jail was hard, really, really hard, especially in this county and Marion County. Like, people make fun of cripples and beat up on cripples and not try to play poor pity me. But, you know, they called me Timmy in the county jail. You ever watch South Park?
Mm-hmm.
Timmy.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Just, yeah. But, you know, I learned to laugh with them instead of taking this stuff to heart. Leaving jail with no money, no nothing, like, it's really hard. You have to go to the shelters and deal with the cops looking at you because you're out panhandling for either your drug or food. And, you know, sometimes you don't have the money to go to the Shalom or the bus money or whatever, and you don't feel like walking it, so you go panhandle, and cops really look down on homeless people and people panhandling. Plus, it's hard for a homeless guy or person if they have no income, or I get SSI, but even in my situation, it's hard for us to get an apartment, because every apartment in this town, you need a cosigner. I filled out applications for a couple apartments, and they said that they approve of the application, but I need a co-signer. Like somebody that'll sign the application with me, so, you know, if I don't pay rent, they'll pay my rent for me. And, yeah, it's kind of rough. Especially if you have felonies. Felonies makes it hard to get a job in this town. Like, I fill out application after application trying to find me a part-time job. Felonies makes it hard for apartments, especially whenever it's a battery charge. Battery bodily waste for spinning on a cop. Oops. Back in my drinking days. All up and down Kirkwood now, they got no panhandling sign. Don't encourage panhandlers and stuff like that. You know, if the cops were in our shoes, on the streets, nothing to turn to, they'd do the same thing. You know, they just think that they're better than us. Not trying to sound like I'm judging them at all, you know, because they ain't messing with me no more. They used to hate me. Mm. Hated me.
Yeah.
Because I was one of the best panhandlers on the streets. Like, usually people hold a sign, I'd walk up to people, like, could you help a cripple get something to eat? You know. 9 times out of 10, they'd give me money and then go buy me food, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I'd go to my resting spot and rest for the day. I'm from Indianapolis. I'm from the South Side. In Indianapolis, cops really don't mess with panhandlers. They don't. But it's because all the college students in this town that the cops watch out for them and they arrest them. Like, they've got more homeless people in jail than other people. I mean, they've got 2 or 3 blocks full of homeless people. Like this last time I was in jail about almost 8 months ago, there were more homeless people than there was other people. It could be 3 days or it could be a week or a month, you know, it just depends on what the judge in this county wants to do. They'd put me in the car, they'd send me to the drunk tank for 2 days, and I'd be laying on concrete with no blanket, no mat, no nothing. Happened to have like 10 guys watching me use the restroom, and you know. Whenever I was living on the streets, my day-to-day thing was to wake up in either the Interfaith Winter Shelter if it was too cold outside, or you'd sleep on concrete floors in the parking garages, but every morning you'd get woken up at like 5 or 6 in the morning by a cop telling you, hey, get out or you'll be arrested. Or sometimes the cops want to be straight jerks and just arrest you on spot and take you to jail anyway. Just mattered on what mood they were in, I guess. And yeah, whenever I was living on the streets, I'd go a month and a half to 2 months with no shaving, showering, nothing. A lot of people's been dying of OD. I've heard of 3 people this past week that's passed away on the streets because of OD on heroin or spice. Yeah, cops don't like people with addictions. They want them to shut down the Shalom Center, which is the safe haven for many addicts and homeless people to go during the day. You know, like the coffee shops and Taco Bell and stuff like that don't allow homeless, and cops trying to shoo all the homeless people away. Like, you know, all the college students been complaining that they all were panhandling and this and that, and yeah, they don't like them. I mean, they do their job, you know, what they're supposed to do, what their chief tells them to do, but yeah. Like, they call them in and the cops have to come and either arrest them or shoo them away. Tell them to go elsewhere, and then they go on the east side of town or the west side and get shooed off by cops over there.
Do you have any vision about what you think would be a better way to kind of help folks that are experiencing homelessness or addiction or any of that, like better than the cops and better than the system that exists now?
Just they need a place where, you know, even if they're dealing with addictions or something, they can always go get help without getting shooed away. You know, Shalom's like that to an extent, but if you're doing it too much, worse is gonna kick you out and you won't be able to go take a shower, nothing. And that's the only place where a homeless person can go take a shower.
So, particularly if you are dealing with addiction, like something that's lacking this in this town, like you said, Shalom is a safe haven and they do good work, I believe, but they close at 4 and they're not open on the weekends.
More sober living houses. You know, I know they got the rec, they got the place I live in called Courage to Change, and they got the Amethyst, but they can only take in so many people. Plus, in our house, you have to pay rent. You know, just people to help homeless people with rent until they can get, you know, a job.
Addiction is a 24/7 thing you deal with, but there is no 24/7 solution here in town.
Right, that, yes.
You know, you can't just say, well, before 4, I'm going to go deal with it, you know.
Right, yeah.
There's a lot of misconceptions in town about homeless folks and people that have been incarcerated. You know, there's a lot of bias against people in both of those.
People think that people choose to be on the streets. Like 80, 90% of them don't. You know, they just had a rough life growing up and then basically got sent to the streets. Like, I know quite a few people that I, you know, associate with every now and then. They're like, if someone would just give me a job or give me a stable place to lay my head, I'd be able to go get me a job.
Now we'll hear from Billy Young, whose music we heard in Kiteline episode 24, The Muse on the Inside. Here's Billy with some of his story.
There was a point in my life where 2.5 years went by, and some of the time of that was spent sleeping on the ground. So that is a nightmare I cannot describe in words, that's kind of what the song is about. It's a day in the life of a homeless person, going to a shelter in the morning, maybe having some coffee. Starts out like that. You can't quite get caught up. You're trying to get your life together. It's just like, and then at lunchtime you get to eat, and then towards the end of the day, you struggle to try to go to sleep or even just to lay down or have a place to lay down. So the offshoot of the song is, don't be abrasive, just try to go peaceful. Don't bite it. Don't force it. It's the message of the song, and that's kind of the way I was able to get through the night myself. I'm not sure that will work for other people, but I'm trying to put a good message out that's what I did, and maybe it'll work for you. And so the song is mainly to bring about awareness. A lot of people don't know what homelessness is or what it feels like and what you go through. So that's why I wrote the song, but it came really quickly. One day I got up and there was the song. I wrote it. And then it took me a long time to refine it in the lyric end. So that's that one. The second thing that I tried to play tonight was Last Time. It's called that. And it's about lack of foresight, which bleeds into everyone. You meet someone, or you have a friend, or you have a family member, or you're very close to someone. It's about seeing that person for the last time, but you do not know it. You don't have the foresight to know. And then sometimes you get past that and they're gone, and you don't even remember what that last time was. Maybe it's months later or whatever, and you don't have that recollection. So it's about trying to take that not for granted and to treat everyone like it's the last time. That's the message of that song. However, it came from living in the streets of Bloomington. Both these songs are from the experiences that I had. I've written a lot of other songs about that subject, and while it's pretty dark, I think it's crucial that people know to prevent other people, innocent people, that are going through it, and maybe we can somehow come up with a better answer to what's going on with it, because there's a lot of controversy about it. A lot of assumptions are made, and they're not, well, I'll put it this way, they're false. They're falsehoods, and there are a lot of good people that I met, and I'm trying to help them myself with a bike project. I try to give these bicycles away to them, because maybe they can get to a job. Maybe they can work their way up. I'm still trying to work my way up. And I went homeless in 2011, and what is it, 5 years later, and I'm still not out. So if that gives you any idea what we're talking about here. You try to rebuild your life, and it's kind of like you're reborn, and you try to regain everything, and you're wiser, and you know how the system works, but the system works against you, and you can't hardly overcome it. It's really hard. Like, it took a year and a half, as an example, for me to get my driver's license back. It took me nearly 2 years to obtain a job that's substantial. It's just really hard. The incarceration part sets someone so far back. You know, once you get a charge on you, people won't hire you. People will not rent to you a place. There's a lot of people a lot worse off than me that have families that are affected, children, their girlfriend or whatever. It's all negative in their way, and I play music too because I love those people, and I'm trying to write so more and more people will know. There's a lot of innocence there, and a lot of people just kind of blow it off and they don't want to think about it, but they're 1 or 2 weeks away from it too. You're looking at somebody that's really old. What's really peculiar and what happened to me as far as incarceration was that I lived my whole life and never got into any trouble. And I chose to be homeless because I had a real bad situation where my family had passed and I was living with these people. I didn't want to live there anymore. So, and I didn't have any reason to stay where I'm from, Indianapolis. So I came here, and all of a sudden, I get arrested for the first time, and I've been on the planet for 50 some years. What am I busted for? Alcohol. Alcohol is promoted on every corner in this country, and it's no answer to anything. And I always drank casual my whole life and never had a problem. But when I went home, I was very depressed, and I drank to try to cover it up. And it would get you through the few hours, and then, you know, bam, you're paying the dues. I probably got busted maybe 12 times, and I'd never been in trouble before. I didn't have any money for bail. Nobody knew me, so nobody was going to bail me out. And what that did was destroy any positive things I had built up, any of the friendships that I had, which were not very many, and any of the connections I had. Shalom Center was one, New Leaf, New Life was another. I had music. Those things were destroyed when I was locked up. The whole time that I was in there, it just makes you more depressed. It's not a positive thing in any way for anyone to be caged. And when you're homeless, you know, what they do is they bring you in there and you're brought up on a charge. And they put you in jail, and if you don't have the money to get out, you stay in there, whether you're innocent or not. And then you're brought up a plea bargain thing, and you usually go for that just so you can get out. So you always say you're guilty no matter what. And it's just a really stacked deck in the favor of the corrupt justice system. And they're making money from it, and they've gotten away with it for so long that it's like normal to them now. And I don't even think they think about it. They've got it built up so far. If you have the money, you buy your way out. If you don't, you suffer twice as much because you can't get out. And so I go to this little thing called Reentry Collective out of New Leaf, New Life. Lindsay Badger has that, and we try to talk about what can we do about the court systems, jails, prisons. And New Leaf, New Life is actually set up to try to help someone reenter their life after they get out, whether it's Monroe County or some prison somewhere off in Indiana. But the problem is there's only so few people trying to help, and there's so many people in the justice system. It's basically all about money. That's not equality. The thing that I really remember more than anything was, you know how some people drink and then they go and cause trouble. I never did that. It was all about the police knew who I was. They knew that I was homeless. And it was almost like I felt like a victim to them. And they would like capitalize on that fact. That's what it felt like to me. I would try to hide from them a lot. I felt I had a right to drink. It's legal. And yet they're busting people for it. So, I mean, it's just a petty charge. But now I'm paying the consequences by not being able to get a job. That's all on my record. I look at the whole justice system as corrupt, and nobody's trying to do a whole lot about it. It's very powerful. It's so powerful that where do you start? How can you change it? And the only thing we can do is come together as people on this, on the outside of it, and say, this is wrong. There's a lot of wrongdoing here. There's a whole lot we need to take a look at, and we need to review it, and we need to rethink that system. I think what I've noticed about a lot of the people I've met, like I volunteer in a lot of places, like the shelter, I do the interfaith thing. I volunteered at my job. That's how I kind of got it, Restore. But the normal person who hasn't been there, they're not informed. That's what I find. Like I have questions thrown at me from people like, I thought all the homeless were bad people. I work with actual people that think that those people deserve, that they didn't put enough effort for it to keep themselves from getting homeless. They think that they could have stopped it. No, that's not what happened. This was our country itself that put people homeless. And it wasn't their fault. They're innocent people. What we're talking about here is, like, in my example, I went homeless, and then I'm arrested. Then what happens after incarceration is you can't rebuild your life because of that history, that darkness. So you have somebody innocent who's homeless, or you're incarcerated and you become homeless when you get released. And then that blooms into drinking a little harder, and then you just wind up in prison. Luckily, I didn't wind up in prison. Monroe County is not a good place to be in. When they put you in the tank, it's, I don't know how they get away with the tank in there. It's very inhumane. But anyway, you can't get out, and you haven't even gone to court yet. So that's against your constitutional rights. If you don't have the money to get out, they shouldn't be able to keep you in there, you know. Here's the thing. They think they're doing you a favor. Well, they busted you for drinking. They don't want you on the street. This is a bad image kind of thing. And I don't blame them for that. But at the same time, you have no option. And they're making money from it. When you're in jail, even if you don't have any money, they're making money off of that. So how do you say that system is any good? It's beyond me. People are just being treated like they're not even alive. They're non-entities in that system.
Thanks to everyone who helped with today's episode. This has been KiteLine. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, KiteLine Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. KiteLine wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message to be played on the air at 812-269-2512, or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one behind bars. You can hear previous episodes of our show or get more information on the prisoners or stories covered on KiteLine at our website, kitelineradio.noblogs.org. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for more stories, news, and insights about the impact of prison on our communities. Thank you for listening.